Hello, I'm Merrick Schneider. Welcome to this podcast of articles from the Wall Street Journal, a presentation of AIRS LA. You are listening to this recording, which is provided for the use of those who are blind or print impaired. Material or items read on AIRS LA are the copyrighted property of the original authors and publishers. No unauthorized use or duplication is permitted. The first article is by Daniel Atz. Walking longer, not necessarily more, shows a big health benefit. Then we have something by Alicia Finley, the college students who cannot do elementary math. And Jesse Newman and Dean Theo wrote, thrifty Americans are testing the limits of leftovers. And we've got John Kleiman and Jamal Brinson's article, to build a better humanoid robot, hands are key. And we'll follow that up with Peggy Noonan's Don't Be Shy, Gratitude is Good for You. All these articles are from recent editions of the Wall Street Journal. So let's begin with today's first one. Walking longer, not necessarily more, shows big health benefits. Everyone knows walking is good for you, and many of us count our daily steps. But is it better to take a longer walk than a comparable number of steps spread across the day? A multinational team of researchers set out to find the answer. Between 2006 and 2010, they recruited adult volunteers from a large-scale health database in Britain, limiting the project to those who averaged less than 8,000 daily steps. It was an older group, ages 40 to 79, with an average of 62, and fairly sedentary, taking a median of 5,165 steps a day. The researchers eliminated those with cancer or cardiovascular disease. The 33,560 who made the final cut wore a monitor for about 7 days to establish how much they typically walk. Participants were sorted into four categories according to whether they accumulated most of their steps in walks of 5 minutes or less, 5 to 10 minutes, 10 to 15 minutes, or longer than 15 minutes. Scientists tracked them during a 9.5-year study period and published their results at annals.org, the website of the Annals of Internal Medicine. The main finding, a longer daily walk seems to beat a lot of incidental steps, but there is no need to trek for hours on end. Participants who walk mainly in bouts of at least 15 minutes had an 83% lower risk of dying than those whose walks occurred in bursts of less than 5 minutes. The risk of cardiovascular disease, such as heart attack or stroke, was 68% lower for the longer session walkers compared with the shortest burst walkers. The study found health benefits even for sedentary people who lengthened their walking session but didn't dramatically increase their steps. We tend to place all the emphasis on the number of steps or the total amount of walking, but neglect the crucial role of patterns, says Emmanuel Stamatakis, one of the paper's authors, who is director of the University of Sydney's Mackenzie Wearables Research Hub in Sydney, Australia. The study shows that even people who are very physically inactive can maximize their heart health benefits by tweaking their walking patterns to walk for longer at a time, ideally for at least 10 to 15 minutes. As usual in such studies, it is hard to prove that longer walks cause the observed outcomes. Longer lives and less cardiovascular disease. It is possible, after all, that those prone to longer walks were healthier to begin with. In fact, those in the sub-5-minute category were more sedentary, had a higher prevalence of overweight or obesity, and were less likely to have a university degree. Participants taking longer walks were more active, were of normal weight, and had higher educational attainment. But the researchers took steps, so to speak, to determine whether better health caused the longer walks rather than vice versa. For instance, they analyzed their findings after excluding volunteers who were frail or reported fair or poor health, yet results were still consistent with those of our main analysis. Nor did adjustment for walking pace, caloric intake, or various biomarkers materially change our observed association. Hayden Doherty, a professor of biomedical informatics at the University of Oxford's Nutfield Department of Population and Health in Oxford, England, said the study was conducted by some of the world's leading physical activity researchers and introduced an interesting new concept, but the results do need to be replicated in other studies in other countries to see if this might be due to causation rather than correlation. Meanwhile, he urged adults to aim for at least 150 minutes of moderate activity a week, adding that every move does count. Now, the college students who can't do elementary math. Kids in elementary school learn, or are supposed to learn, how to add fractions and round numbers. But many students at the University of California, San Diego, a top public university ranked sixth nationally by United States News and World Report, can't do either, according to a newest analysis from the university. Read and weep for the future of America. Roughly 1 in 8 freshmen lack rudimentary high school math skills defined as geometry, algebra, and algebra 2. It gets worse. Students who have been placed in a remedial high school math class in 2023 had roughly fifth grade level abilities. Only 39% could correctly round the number 374,518 to the nearest 100, a third grade scale. Because so many incoming students were numerically illiterate, the university added a remedial class for middle and elementary school math. Remarkably, among students placed into that math course, 94% had completed an advanced math class in high school, pre-calculus, calculus, or statistics, and received an average A minus in their math course. Is this an indictment of A, the University of California's admissions, B, public K-12 schools, C, U.S. News and World Report's college rankings, or D, all of the above? If you choose D, you are correct. Start with A. The UC Board of Regents back in 2020 scrapped standardized test as an admissions requirement under the guise of promoting equality. The likely real reason? Blacks and Hispanics score lower on average on the SAT. Requiring applicants to submit standardized test scores could also make it easier for critics to prove the university is providing racial preferences, which were prohibited by a 1996 voter referendum. The math proficiency analysis suggest it may be doing so on the sly. Amid a push to boost diversity and overall enrollment, and thus rake in more government student aid, UC San Diego admitted increasing numbers of unqualified applicants from low-income high schools. In order to holistically admit a diverse and representative class, we need to admit students who may be at a higher risk of not succeeding, the report said. This has done a grave disservice to ill-prepared students who take longer to complete degrees and thus accrue more debt and drop out of more rigorous majors. Few, if any, students who take remedial math successfully complete an engineering degree, the report notes. The university's admissions place a heavy emphasis on GPAs, but these do not reliably reflect student preparation because grades are inflated. Some students may also cheat their way to high grades. Smartphones and AI have made it easier to do so. At the same time, scores on AP tests have become a less dependable marker of merit. That's because the College Board has made the exams easier to pass to encourage more students to take them and thus rake in more money from testing fees. The share of students passing AP exam have soared over the last two decades, including for calculus AB, 6.3 percentage points, English language and composition, 17.9, chemistry, 21.9, and United States history, 23.3. Call it vanity grading. Mediocre students now graduate with top GPAs and AP scores, which makes parents feel better about their kids' public schools and eases political pressure for education reform. On to answer B. The report says students have been underserved by their prior schooling. No kidding. Only 22% of 12th graders scored proficient in math on the National Assessment of Educational Progress last year, the lowest on record. One UC San Diego remedial math tutor observed that some teachers would teach life skills in high school math class, just using calculators, the internet, and prescribed formulas. Classes did not teach mathematical thinking. One problem is union contracts protect lousy and lazy teachers from being fired and prevent talented, hardworking ones from being rewarded with higher pay. Meanwhile, some of the profession's best teachers, highly capable women who entered the profession when their sex had fewer career options, have been retiring. Many of their replacements are lacking. Teacher credential programs typically require only a C-plus average in undergrad. With the pervasive grade inflation in colleges, many young teachers may themselves have only fifth grade math skills. Answer C. Many parents mistakenly consider the U.S. News and World Report rankings a proxy of a college's prestige. But the rankings do not reflect the caliber of students a college admits, nor graduate outcomes that matter. The rankings do not factor in student standardized test scores for colleges like the UCs that do not require them. Graduation and retention rates make up by far the biggest weight in the rankings, but that may encourage colleges to inflate grades to ensure that unqualified applicants that they admit still graduate. Graduate employment outcomes account for only 5% of the rankings weight. To its credit, the UC San Diego report recommends reinstating a standardized testing admission requirement. This might help, but that Titanic may have sailed. After many colleges made standardized tests optional, the College Board last year dumbed down the SAT in an effort to encourage more students to take it. The test now takes 2 hours instead of three, and students get more time to complete each question. Gone too are long reading passages that might strain TikTok attention spans. Analogies were eliminated in 2005 after academics claimed they were culturally biased. The sum of all this is a tragedy of the educational commons. Institutions acting in their own interest are debasing America's school of young human capital. Heaven help us. And now, thrifty Americans are testing the limits of leftovers. Bone bags, pizza eggs, fridge foraging. Welcome to the Leftover Olympics. For years, uneaten hot dogs and half-empty cans of tomato paste languishing in the fridge have charted a quick path to the trash in American kitchens. Now, thanks to inflation and stubbornly high grocery bills, they're more often getting promoted, sometimes to the main course. Take Kelly Bear's bone bags. The Chicago-based architecture professor stashes vegetable scraps and leftover meat bones in plastic bags in her freezer. Once filled, the contents go into an Instapot with water and apple cider vinegar, brewing broth that Bear uses in soups, rice, and quinoa. Restaurants have become a source too. After bones from a rack of barbecue ribs produced her best broth so far, Blair, her husband, and their two sons now dutifully haul home any leftover bones, beef, pork, or chicken. Everyone is really well trained, said Bear, who is motivated by food waste and finances. Sarah Dugal, a development coordinator in Plymouth, Minnesota, is equally intent on optimizing every bit of food on the plate when she eats out, which, like many Americans, is less often these days. Chinese takeout, extra rice becomes a fried rice dinner. Leftover pizza gets cut up, crisped on the stove, and mixed into scrambled eggs, a remnant from Dugal's college days that she has christened pizza eggs. Everything from Parmesan rind to a quarter can of coconut milk is fair game for one of Nora Schlesinger's leftover nights, in which all four members of her family can wind up eating a different meal. The 41-year-old business consultant is a leftover diehard, batch cooking and freezing meals or piecing together spare ingredients into college-like creations. I do that beautiful mind thing where things float into place and I create something new, Schlesinger said, referring to Nobel Prize-winning mathematician John Nash's kaleidoscope approach. The method requires multiple freezers in her suburban Chicago home. Her husband, Brian Den Hartog, is on board. The kitchen sink meal tastes good, save money, and happily result in fewer dishes. I am responsible for cleaning up, he said. The couple's two children are usually game for leftovers too, and Schlesinger is not shy about relaying how much effort goes into making them appetizing. I'm not a traditional wife influencer, she said. It's a lot of work. Rampant inflation that followed the COVID-19 pandemic led Americans to spend the highest proportion of their income on food in roughly three decades. While food prices have generally stabilized since then, some staples like beef, coffee, and chocolate keep getting costlier. On Wall Street, consumers' dedication to leftovers is closely tracked. And analyst John Baumgartner, who has been surveying consumer leftover habits for 15 years, said 49% of respondents in October reported eating more leftovers than 6 months ago, a record since the survey began. Usually it's around 20%, Baumgartner said. These days, even high-income consumers are upping their game, with usage among those earning more than $200,000 annually increasing 4% since July. Big food companies like General Mills and Conagra say economic pressures have more people cooking from scratch and scraping their plate into Tupperware containers. Some are tapping into that trend. The Thanksgiving holiday and mountains of leftover turkey, Kraft is selling its Heinz home-style turkey gravy with a new squeezable bottle. The bottle, sold for a limited time, is labeled leftover gravy. Nashville-based food blogger and restaurateur Amanda Fredrickson has helped popularize the practice of fridge foraging on social media. About 8 years ago, she launched a series of Instagram videos in which she whips up meals using leftovers and other odds and ends she finds in her fridge. The series quickly found a following among budget-conscious cooks and became even more popular during the pandemic when the household masses had few options besides cooking at home. Fredrickson put the series on pause last year after opening two of her five restaurants, but it brought it back over this past summer. We're all trying to figure out what to make for dinner, and we're all trying to save money on groceries, Fredrickson said. If you throw away food, you're literally throwing away your money. Thanksgiving will offer a chance to get crafty with holiday staples. I've taken mashed potatoes and turned them into waffles, like savory waffles for my kids, she said. The leftovers era does have its limits. Baumgartner, the Wall Street analyst, that he's tried his hand at repurposing grilled steak, but grew wary after it lingered a few days in its fridge. On Monday, it's like, all right, this is great, he said. By Wednesday, Thursday, I'll look at it and think, I'll get something fresh instead. The agriculture department provides a handy how-to for dealing with leftover food, advising consumers on wrapping, reheating, and thawing, and handling what the agency called leftovers. I never really dreaded the end of the week until I started eating leftovers, Baumgartner said. Back at Bone Bag headquarters, Bear's mother won't set foot in her daughter's home for 2 days after she's cooked up a batch of broth because the smell reminds her of her colonoscopy prep, a dreaded medical ritual in which liquid is one of only a few sanctioned meals. It really does smell up the house, Bear acknowledged. And now, to build a better humanoid robot, hands are key. Armies of humanoid robots are poised to march into the world factories. But before they are ready to turn a wrench, they must solve what Elon Musk called the hands problem. Creating the mechanical equivalent of the human hand is a challenge that has been stumping corporate and academic researchers for years. Replacing muscle and skin with motors and sensors is a critical step in making humanoids a versatile source of labor, potentially unlocking a global market that Morgan Stanley estimates could reach $5 trillion by 2050. We're setting 10 years as our goal to have dexterity be functional and useful and able to do some of the things that humans do, said Kevin Lynch of Northwestern University Center for Robotics and Biosystems, part of a federally funded consortium that is developing robotic hands for a variety of workplaces. It's not next year, that's for sure. His lab is using a hand made by the UK company Shadow Robot as a base model while it tries to create improved versions. On a recent afternoon, PhD student Toby Buckley, manipulating a pair of the hands through remote control gloves, performed exercises that would be familiar to a toddler, such as stacking plastic rings on a base and dropping small cubes into a cup. The hands are driven by motors that are packed into forearms the size of coffee cans. The fingertips contain sensors that record how the electrical properties of a fluid beneath the skin changes when the fingers contact an object, interpreting the data as a sense of touch. Lynch said the robotic hand of the future will need many more sensors to better emulate a human hand. Holding a pencil, for example, would require sensors along the sides of several big fingers. Most recently said that Tesla's humanoid robot, called Optimus, is good at walking, but making hands that can match a human has been a far tougher job. In order to have a useful generalized robot, you do need this, he said. You do need an incredible hand. Some researchers have concluded that a robotic hand does not need five fingers to be useful. Mechanical engineering professor Mattai Fiocardi and his colleagues at Columbia University have developed a four-fingered hand that operates without visual feedback, identifying objects by touching them. It is nimble enough to twirl a delicate paper cylinder without crushing it, though in a recent demonstration, the object occasionally slipped from the hand's grasp. That left the fingers twitching fruitlessly, but even a failed attempt creates data that will be used in training. The robot essentially learns by doing, Fiocardi said. Boston Dynamics, a robotics company owned by Hyundai Motor Group, has equipped its Atlas humanoids with hands that only have three fingers. They can form a palm that allows the robot to lift boxes or brace itself. One digit can also rotate to serve as a thumb, letting the robot grasp objects. Atlas has yet to be put to work in factories, but videos put out by Boston Dynamics show the humanoid picking up auto parts, pumping a dumbbell, and plucking a tissue from a box. Alberto Rodriguez, director of robot behavior and AI strategy for Atlas, said a robotic hand must make trade-offs between strength, dexterity, slenderness, and ruggedness. Increasing one attribute can diminish another, he said. The current version, which Rodriguez refers to as a gripper, can pick up a variety of objects, including heavy ones. The next one is being designed to use tools or fish an object out of a bin while still keeping its strength. Not good enough for us to put out a gripper that is going to be weak or it's going to be subpar to the performance of a robot that is meant to lift heavy objects, that is meant to move fast, he said. Industrial robots have relied on pincer-like hands for decades, and Igor Kulikov, co-founder and chief executive of the San Francisco-based robot maker Microfactory, says that it is still the most cost-effective form. His company produces a $5,000 robot that has two arms, one of which typically is equipped with a tool, the other with a two-digit gripper that holds an object in place. That setup, he said, can perform most of the functions needed for electronics assembly, such as soldering, inserting screws, or peeling off protective films. Rich Walker, director of Shadow Robot, said creating a human-like hand carries many difficulties, particularly when it comes to matching features such as skin that can repair itself and joints that provide their own lubrication. There are fundamental problems with materials that at the moment product engineering has no idea about, he said. The difficulties of recreating the human hand lead to questions about why it is being done, given that the real thing already exists. At Colgate, a Northwestern University mechanical engineering professor who leads the consortium developing robotic hands, said the shortage of workers for factory and caregiving jobs is driving the need for alternatives. He said a breakthrough also could allow small manufacturers to flourish in the same way that personal computers brought mainframe power to the masses. It might create new and compelling jobs, he said. That's kind of why we're doing it. And now we do have one more. Don't be shy. Gratitude is good for you. Practical advice from one Charles Dickens in Sketches by Boz. Reflect upon your present blessings, of which every man has many, not on your past misfortunes, of which all men have some. G.K. Chesterton took a different tack. Gratitude is the highest form of thought. Tolstoy took it even a step further. You can infer from his work that he thought the moments in which we feel the greatest thankfulness are those in which we are most noble. Don't be embarrassed by talk of gratitude during Thanksgiving or think it rote or corny. Feel thankful enough, long enough, and it amounts to a stance towards life, a good one. I did nothing to earn the snow-capped mountain on the horizon, and yet there it is, filling my eyes and soul with wonder. Thank you, God, or thank you, mystery, but thank you. What are you thankful for this year? We'll start big and go small, knowing small is big, too. Big is from Harvard University political science, Graham Allison, who wrote to me recently to share the three reasons he gives thanks this Thanksgiving, 80, 80, and 9. Many readers will know what these numbers signify, the remarkable achievements that most of us have enjoyed all our lives. The first 80, since Japanese surrendered in September 1945, the world has lived in the longest peace, the longest period without great power war since the Roman Empire. The second 80 is the answer to the question, how many years has it been since nuclear weapons were used in war? Had anyone been asked to bet about this in 1950 or 1960, they could have gotten 1,000-to-1 odds against this outcome. The 9, he says, may be the most incredible of all. How many states have nuclear arsenals? We rightly fear nuclear proliferation, and yet amazing grace and good fortune and admirable post-war statecraft actually bent the arc of history. More than 100 nations have the resources to build nuclear weapons, Mr. Allison said. Instead, they've chosen to rely on the security guarantees of others. This is wonderful and historically unnatural. Much of what made this happen is being eroded. But for now, in just a moment, think of the genius that went into making 80, 80, and 9. and be grateful. The thinking of Mr. Allison and his collaborator, James A. Winnerfield Jr., on how to renew progress is in the latest issue of Foreign Affairs. I asked some friends what they personally found themselves most thankful for this year. Two shot immediate replies. One, a professor, age 70, said his thoughts continually returned to a doctor's genius. Back in 2012, I suddenly lost vision in one eye because of a detached retina. After restoring my sight, a surgeon noted a tiny retinal tear in my other eye and fixed it with a laser. Were not for medical advances, I would probably be blind. He can't stop thinking how grateful he is for all the modern medicine miracles, antibiotics, vaccines, surgical technology, all the rest. Another friend, a think tanker in the same age group, said, advances in cancer treatment and a wonderful doctor, which have kept my father-in-law alive in a situation which in generations past would have likely produced a quick and negative outcome. Here's to the doctors and nurses and scientists. Thanks to Tatiana Schlotzberg for her cool, brave, brilliant reporting on her struggle with cancer in the New Yorker. She especially toasts nurses should take over. They should. My friend Lloyd the lawyer, in his 60s, cited three special objects of gratitude this year. Old college friends who show how they care through their candor, his Shabbat morning Bible study group, they are sharp, warm, and skeptical, and what happens when he walks the dogs each day just before dawn on the Westchester shore. He sees the sun creep over the Long Island Sound. It feels like the sleep and glory of creation. I'm grateful I have work, that I get to be a writer in America, that I've been able to earn my living that way and to know so many of my readers. I've met them traveling the country the past 35 years. We talk at speeches, conferences, book events, dinners, and I know who they are. They are the people who make America work. They're the doctor on the local hospital board, the businesswoman helping local education, the volunteers in the group that helps new mothers, the store owners heading the downtown revitalization effort. Sometimes they disagree with me on politics, but we're kind of old friends. We came up together and they forgive me. They make America live each day. I am a writer in America and I get to be with them, hear from them. Isn't it corny to say this moves me? But this moves me quickly. I'm grateful for this moment, a small thrown together dinner of old friends. Thank you, you are precious to me. And near the end, my friend Richard and I creep into the TV room to catch the end of a World Series game. We watched silently, and then he said, it's a privilege to be here in the age of Ohtani. I said, oh my gosh, that's the word, privilege. And at that moment, I remembered an older friend, no longer with us, whom I always envied because as a boy, he'd go to Yankee Stadium and see Joe DiMaggio play, the great DiMaggio, who does all things perfectly, as Hemingway put it. My late friend always told me it wasn't just DiMaggio hitting, it was his fielding, fluid like liquid. And there in the TV room, I realized I have my Jolton Joe, Shohei Ohtani, I am grateful for you. I am grateful for a little blonde boy, just over a year old, with a funny gray face. There is a thing about him, a courtesy, or what I read as courtesy. When he meets adults, he stares at them and takes them in, then kindly smiles and gurgles and lets them pat him, ruffle his hair, and take his face in their hands. Then he returns to the thoughts that really occupy his mind. The ball is a ball and is round. What is round? He stares at it in his hand, but he's so patient in how he allows you to fuss, as all around him do. There are studies that say you get happier as you get older, and from what I observe and experience, especially this year, it's true. The great decisions, which are all on some level great gambles, the profession, the partner, the people, and places you seek have been made, the results are in. No one gets it wholly right, but you survey the field of your life and cock your head, and you confide more because you know your fellow travelers, the friend who had to struggle with professional disappointments, she now understands are final, or the personal ones that cannot be changed. But all the compensations, all the progress anyway. All the grown-ups know what John F. Kennedy said in words that are famous because they are what everyone has always said and been right, right. Life is unfair, and still it is beautiful, magnificent. You want to take its space in your hands. That brings us to the end of today's articles. I'm Merrick Schneider, and I will be back soon with more articles. Thank you for listening.